like those of the Jesuit exercitia, it is fundamentally different in that the meditator remains completely devoid of any conscious goal or program. Thus, the meditation becomes the solitary experiment of a free individual, which is the reverse of a guided attempt to master the unconscious. This, however, is not the place to enter into a detailed analysis of active imagination. The reader will find one of Jung's descriptions of it in his paper on the transcendent function. In the woman's meditation, the self appeared as a deer, which said to the ego, "I am your child and your mother. They call me the connecting animal because I connect people, animals, and even stones with one another if I enter them. I am your fate, or the objective I. When I appear, I redeem you from the meaningless hazards of life. The fire burning inside me burns in the whole of nature. If a man loses it, he becomes egocentric, lonely, disoriented, and weak." The self is often symbolized as an animal, representing our instinctive nature and its connectedness with one's surroundings. That is why there are so many helpful animals in myths and fairy tales. This relation of the self to all surrounding nature and even the cosmos probably comes from the fact that the nuclear atom of our psyche is somehow woven into the whole world, both outer and inner. All the higher manifestations of life are somehow tuned to the surrounding space-time continuum. Animals, for example, have their own special foods, their particular home-building materials, and their definite territories, to all of which their instinctive patterns are exactly tuned and adapted. Time rhythms also play their part. We have only to think of the fact that most grass-eating animals have their young at precisely the time of year when the grass is richest and most abundant. With such considerations in mind, a well-known zoologist has said that the inwardness of each animal reaches far out into the world around it and psychifies time and space. In ways that are still completely beyond our comprehension, our unconscious is similarly attuned to our surroundings, to our group, to society in general, and beyond these, to the space-time continuum and the whole of nature. Thus, the great man of the Naskapi Indians does not merely reveal inner truths, he also gives hints about where and when to hunt. And so, from dreams, the Naskapi hunter evolves the words and melodies of the magical songs with which he attracts the animals. But this specific help from the unconscious is not given to primitive man alone. Jung discovered that dreams can also give civilized man the guidance he needs in finding his way through the problems of both his inner and his outer life. Indeed, many of our dreams are concerned with details of our outer life and our surroundings, such things as the tree in front of the window, one's bicycle or car, or a stone picked up during a walk, may be raised to the level of symbolism through our dream life and become meaningful. If we pay attention to our dreams, instead of living in a cold, impersonal world of meaningless chance, we may begin to emerge into a world of our own, full of important and secretly ordered events. Our dreams, however, are not, as a rule, primarily concerned with our adaptation to outer life. In our civilized world, most dreams have to do with the development, by the ego, of the right inner attitude toward the self, for this relationship is far more disturbed in us by modern ways of thinking and behaving than is the case with primitive people. They generally live directly from the inner center, but we, with our uprooted consciousness, are so entangled with external, completely foreign matters that it is very difficult for the messages of the self to get through to us. Our conscious mind continually creates the illusion of a clearly shaped, real outer world that blocks off many other perceptions. Yet, through our unconscious nature, we are inexplicably connected to our psychic and physical environment. I have already mentioned the fact that the self is symbolized with special frequency in the form of a stone, precious or otherwise. We saw an example of this in the stone that was being polished by the she-bear and the lions. In many dreams, the nuclear center, the self, also appears as a crystal. The mathematically precise arrangement of a crystal evokes in us the intuitive feeling that even in so-called dead matter, there is a spiritual ordering principle at work. Thus, the crystal often symbolically stands for the union of extreme opposites, of matter and spirit. Perhaps crystals and stones are especially apt symbols of the self because of the just so-ness of their nature. Many people cannot refrain from picking up stones of a slightly unusual color or shape and keeping them without knowing why they do this. It is as if the stones held a living mystery that fascinates them. men have collected stones since the beginning of time, and have apparently assumed that certain ones were the containers of the life force, with all its mystery. The ancient Germans, for instance, believed that the spirits of the dead continued to live in their tombstones. The custom of placing stones on graves may spring partly from the symbolic idea that something eternal of the dead person remains, which can be most fittingly represented by a stone. For while the human being is as different as possible from a stone, yet man's innermost center is in a strange and special way akin to it, perhaps because the stone symbolizes mere existence at the farthest remove from the emotions, feelings, fantasies, and discursive thinking of ego consciousness. In this sense, the stone symbolizes what is perhaps the simplest and deepest experience, the experience of something eternal that man can have in those moments when he feels immortal and unalterable. The urge that we find in practically all civilizations to erect stone monuments to famous men, or on the site of important events, probably also stems from this symbolic meaning of the stone. The stone that Jacob placed on the spot where he had his famous dream, or certain stones left by simple people on the tombs of local saints or heroes, show the original nature of the human urge to express an otherwise inexpressible experience by the stone symbol. It is no wonder that many religious cults use a stone to signify God or to mark a place of worship. The holiest sanctuary of the Islamic world is the Kaaba, the black stone in Mecca to which all pious Muslims hope to make their pilgrimage. According to Christian ecclesiastical symbolism, Christ is the stone which the builders rejected, which became the head of the corner. Luke 20:17. Alternatively, he is called the spiritual rock from which the water of life springs. 1 Corinthians 10:4. Medieval alchemists, who searched for the secret of matter in a pre-scientific way, hoping to find God in it, or at least the working of divine activity, believed that this secret was embodied in their famous philosopher's stone. But some of the alchemists dimly perceived that their much sought-after stone was a symbol of something that can be found only within the psyche of man. An old Arabian alchemist, Morienus, said, "This thing, the philosopher's stone, is extracted from you. You are its mineral, and one can find it in you, or, to put it more clearly, they, the alchemists, take it from you. If you recognize this, the love and approbation of the stone will grow within you. Know that this is true without doubt." The alchemical stone, the lapis, symbolizes something that can never be lost or dissolved, something eternal that some alchemists compared to the mystical experience of God within one's own soul. It usually takes prolonged suffering to burn away all the superfluous psychic elements concealing the stone, but some profound inner experience of the self does occur to most people at least once in a lifetime. From the psychological standpoint, a genuinely religious attitude consists of an effort to discover this unique experience and gradually to keep in tune with it. It is relevant that a stone is itself something permanent, so that the self becomes an inner partner toward whom one's attention is continually turned. The fact that this highest and most frequent symbol of the self is an object of lifeless matter points to yet another field of inquiry and speculation, that is, the still unknown relationship between what we call the unconscious psyche and what we call matter, a mystery with which psychosomatic medicine endeavors to grapple. In studying this still undefined and unexplained connection, it may prove to be that psyche and matter are actually the same phenomenon, one observed from within and the other from without. Dr. Jung put forward a new concept that he called synchronicity. This term means a meaningful coincidence of outer and inner events that are not themselves causally connected. The emphasis lies on the word meaningful. If an aircraft crashes before my eyes as I am blowing my nose, this is a coincidence of events that has no meaning. It is simply a chance occurrence of a kind that happens all the time. But if I bought a blue frock and by mistake the shop delivered a black one on the day one of my near relatives died, this would be a meaningful coincidence. The two events are not causally related, but they are connected by the symbolic meaning that our society gives to the color black. Wherever Dr. Jung observed such coincidences in an individual's life, it seemed, as the individual's dreams revealed, that there was an archetype activated in the unconscious of the individual concerned, To illustrate this by my example of the black frock, in such a case, the person who receives the black frock might also have had a dream on the theme of death. It seems as if the underlying archetype is manifesting itself simultaneously in inner and external events. The common denominator is a symbolically expressed message, in this case, a message about death. As soon as we notice that certain types of event like to cluster together at certain times, we begin to understand the attitude of the Chinese, whose theories of medicine, philosophy, and even building are based on a science of meaningful coincidences. The classical Chinese texts did not ask what causes what, but rather what likes to occur with what. One can see much the same underlying theme in astrology and in the way various civilizations have depended on consulting oracles and paying attention to omens. All of these are attempts to provide an explanation of coincidence that is different from one that depends on straightforward cause and effect. In creating the concept of synchronicity, Dr. Jung sketched a way in which we might penetrate deeper into the interrelation of psyche and matter, and it is precisely toward such a relation that the symbol of the stone seems to point. But this is still a completely open and insufficiently explored matter with which future generations of psychologists and physicists must deal. It may seem that my discussion of synchronicity has led me away from my main theme, but I feel it is necessary to make at least a brief introductory reference to it, because it is a Jungian hypothesis that seems to be pregnant with future possibilities of investigation and application. Synchronistic events, moreover, almost invariably accompany the crucial phases of the process of individuation. But too often, they pass unnoticed, because the individual has not learned to watch for such coincidences and to make them meaningful in relation to the symbolism of his dreams. The relation to the self. Nowadays, more and more people, especially those who live in large cities, suffer from a terrible emptiness and boredom, as if they were waiting for something that never arrives. Movies and television, spectator sports and political excitements may divert them for a while, but again and again, exhausted and disenchanted, they have to return to the wasteland of their own lives. The only adventure that is still worthwhile for modern man lies in the inner realm of the unconscious psyche. With this idea vaguely in mind, many now turn to yoga and other Eastern practices, but these offer no genuine new adventure, for in them one only takes over what is already known to the Hindus or the Chinese without directly meeting one's own inner life center. While it is true that Eastern methods serve to concentrate the mind and direct it inward, and that this procedure is in a sense similar to the introversion of an analytical treatment, there is a very important difference. Jung evolved a way of getting to one's inner center and making contact with the living mystery of the unconscious, alone and unaided. That is utterly different from following a well-worn path. Trying to give the living reality of the self a constant amount of daily attention is like trying to live simultaneously on two levels or in two different worlds. One gives one's mind, as before, to outer duties, but at the same time one remains alert for hints and signs, both in dreams and in external events, that the self uses to symbolize its intentions, the direction in which the life stream is moving. Old Chinese texts that are concerned with this kind of experience often use the simile of the cat watching the mouse hole. One text says that one should allow no other thoughts to intrude, but one's attention should not be too sharp, nor should it be too dull. There is exactly the right level of perception. If the training is undergone in this manner, it will be effective as time goes on, and when the cause comes to fruition, like a ripe melon that automatically falls, anything it may happen to touch or make contact with will suddenly cause the individual's awakening. This is the moment when the practitioner will be like one who drinks water and alone knows whether it is cold or warm. He becomes about himself and experiences a great happiness, similar to that one feels in meeting one's own father at the crossroads. Thus, in the midst of ordinary outer life, one is suddenly caught up in an exciting inner adventure, and because it is unique for each individual, it cannot be copied or stolen. There are two main reasons why man loses contact with the regulating center of his soul. One of them is that some single instinctive drive or emotional image can carry him into a one-sidedness that makes him lose his balance. This also happens to animals. For example, a sexually excited stag will completely forget hunger and security. This one-sidedness and consequent loss of balance are much dreaded by primitives who call it loss of soul. Another threat to the inner balance comes from excessive daydreaming, which, in a secret way, usually circles around particular complexes. In fact, daydreams arise just because they connect a man with his complexes. At the same time, they threaten the concentration and continuity of his consciousness. The second obstacle is exactly the opposite, and is due to an over-consolidation of ego consciousness. Although a disciplined consciousness is necessary for the performance of civilized activities, we know what happens if a railway signalman lapses into daydreaming. It has the serious disadvantage that it is apt to block the reception of impulses and messages coming from the center. This is why so many dreams of civilized people are concerned with restoring this receptivity by attempting to correct the attitude of consciousness toward the unconscious center or self. Among the mythological representations of the self, one finds much emphasis on the four corners of the world, and in many pictures the great man is represented in the center of a circle divided into four. Jung used the Hindu word mandala, magic circle, to designate a structure of this order, which is a symbolic representation of the nuclear atom of the human psyche, whose essence we do not know. In this connection, it is interesting that a Naskapi hunter pictorially represented his great man not as a human being, but as a mandala. Whereas the Naskapi experienced the inner center directly and naively, without the help of religious rites or doctrines. Other communities use the mandala motif in order to restore a lost inner balance. For instance, the Navajo Indians try, by means of mandala-structured sand paintings, to bring a sick person back into harmony with himself and with the cosmos, and thereby to restore his health. In Eastern civilizations, similar pictures are used to consolidate the inner being, or to enable one to plunge into deep meditation. The contemplation of a mandala is meant to bring an inner peace, a feeling that life has again found its meaning and order. The mandala also conveys this feeling when it appears spontaneously in the dreams of modern men who are not influenced by any religious tradition of this sort and know nothing about it. Perhaps the positive effect is even greater in such cases, because knowledge and tradition sometimes blur or even block the spontaneous experience. An example of a spontaneously produced mandala occurs in the following dream of a 62-year-old woman. It emerged as a prelude to a new phase of life in which she became very creative. I see a landscape in a dim light.